you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Dr. Joseph Farrell back on the show. Dr. Farrell, how are you doing?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me back on, Tim.
Well, thanks for coming back on the show. We're here tonight. We're going to talk about your book, Rotten to the Common Core, Public Schooling, Standardized Tests, and the Surveillance State. I read the book. It's a great book, by the way.
Thank you.
It packs a lot of punch. It's only a little less than 200 pages, if I remember, but it's a lot in there, and it addresses philosophy, the history of education, and I guess it's the application of technology or technocracy to mm-hmm. modern education. And in the book, you kind of give us a brief history of this goes back to at least to the 19th century. But
right.
In the book, you don't focus so much on the standards of Common Core, which seems to get a lot of press.
Right.
You focus on the testing itself. Well, let's
right.
talk about that focus, and also what motivated you to write this book. It's a little different than what you usually write about, but it is related to what you usually write about.
Oh yeah, it's definitely related. What motivated me personally, I can't speak for my co-author Gary Lawrence, but what motivated me personally was I was for some years of my life. An adjunct professor. I taught at the college level, usually history courses, but some philosophy. And I noticed, you know, not what every college professor has noticed over the years is the declining intellectual capability of students coming into the college system. But I also noticed something else, and that was every time I had education majors in my classes, and I'll be very blunt in this interview. I hope you don't mind, but whenever I had education majors in my classes, they were some of the dumbest, stupidest people I think I have ever taught in my life. I was just literally dumbfounded. I remember one year giving a test, and I even wrote a governor to the state of Oklahoma at the time where I was teaching because I was just so discouraged. I gave a test one year, and I thought this has got to be the be-all and end-all, because one of the students, the first question on the test was, you know, name five provisions of the Treaty of Versailles. And, of course, in the question, I spelled Versailles, Versailles, V-E-R-S-A-I-L-L-E-S. I spelled it out. And one student, incidentally an education major, responded in her answers to the question, the Treaty of Versailles, and she spelled it V-E-R-S-I-G-H in her answer.
Like sigh.
Huh. Like sigh, ver with, you know, sigh with a ver on the front of it. And I, you know, I was literally dumbfounded. How could you be so colossally blockheaded as to misspell something that's spelled correctly in the very question itself? And, you know, this is a pattern that just went on and on and on. But anyway, to get back to your question about why did we focus on the assessment process rather than the standards? The standards themselves, philosophically, are not a big issue as far as we're concerned. The reason is that every academic discipline has an implied canon or set of things that it requires you to know. You know, this has been around as long as there's been education, this idea of some sort of tradition or standard that has to be passed down and that students have to live up to and that professors have to profess. So that wasn't the big problem for us, although in a certain sense it can be, as we're going to see later on. Our problem was the assessment process, the idea that you not only take the standardized, computerized test and, you know, select from pre-selected answers that you're given, you know, and then fill in the oval with your number two lead pencil. The problem is not only do you have all the problems of the standardized test, you've got it on steroids, because in the Common Core assessment process, these standardized tests are now tailored to the individual responses of the person taking the test. So in other words, if you ask a question of a particular thing and the student responds in a particular way the student responds then tailors the way the computer selects the next question. So in other words, you are put in a double bind as a student. First of all, if you recall taking these standardized tests, you literally had to guess what was in the mind of the test preparers. And as we pointed out in the book, oftentimes the questions themselves are just literally wrong. We point out a few examples of some standardized test questions that have appeared on SAT exams and other such things in the past that are just plain wrong and were provably and demonstrably wrong. One example we cite is of a National Merit Scholar student that was taking one of these standardized tests for his National Merit Scholarship. And there was a list of five words, and you were supposed to pick out the word that was misspelled. Well, one of the words was intentionally spelled with an S-I-O-N-A-L-L-Y rather than a T-I-O-N-A-L-L-Y. Well, this student happened to be brighter than the test makers because he knew of a special instance in the logic philosophy of S.I. Hayakawa where the word is spelled that way to imply a certain technical usage, okay? And the Educational Testing Service in Princeton, of course, didn't know about that. And so, you know, he was put in the bad position of guessing whether or not they knew about that special usage or not. And this happens over and over again in standardized tests. Standardized tests really punish the finer, subtler mind. Another example that we cite in the test is, you know, there's a question that appeared on an SAT that in the 1960s, I think it was, that asked the question, the emperor is the name of what? You know, a string quartet, a piano concerto, and so on and so forth. Well, if you know anything about classical music, the first thing you think of is Beethoven's Emperor Concerto.
Yeah.
But, you know, Haydn wrote the Emperor Quartet, and that's not so well known, but if you're an aficionado of classical music, you'll know that. And again, the Educational Testing Service didn't know about the Haydn. So, you know, the students put in the position of literally, if they know things better than the test preparers, they're literally put in the position of having to second guess themselves all the time. And this is really one of the first critiques of standardized tests that there is by people that started looking at them, is they do tend to punish the finer mind. Now, if you go on from that, the other problem of the standardized test is none of these tests really allow you to give your reason for selecting the answer. So, in other words, what standardized tests in effect become, they become loyalty tests for the adherence to a particular narrative. Imagine the standardized test asking you who killed President John F. Kennedy. Well, we know, you know, we know that those tests are going to say Lee Harvey Oswald rather than a conspiracy of, you know, mafia or exiled Cubans or elements of the CIA and so on and so forth, which I think have been admirably documented by JFK researchers over the years since the assassination. Mm-hmm. So in other words, you're essentially being asked to conform to particular narratives, particularly in the soft disciplines like history, sociology, and so on and so forth. So these things, if you can imagine all of this now compounded with a standardized adaptive test system that's computerized, which is what the Common Core assessment process is, you have a double whammy, because now you're having to guess, well, how do I get the best response question given to me by responding to this question? So you're having not only to second guess the answers, you're having to second guess the psychology of anonymous test preparers in Princeton, New Jersey, or wherever they happen to be. So in other words, this one size fits all technocracy that you suggested in your initial opening, this is precisely the problem of Common Core. That's at the core of it. But the other problem, if you look at it, is what it really is about trying to do is almost completely replace the teacher in the classroom, to reduce them to at best being sort of proctors of an examination. And let me give you an example of this one size fits all philosophy. When the book came out, it was last year that it came out, I had not really expected the response that we were going to get to it, but I went to a luncheon in Tulsa, Oklahoma last October, and there were a lot of teachers in attendance at that luncheon. And one lady told me that she had quit teaching after 25 years because of Common Core. And I said, what was your reason to dislike this whole program? She said that she was required under the system to adhere to a lesson plan that was dictated from on high, that she had to be at a certain point by a certain time in her lessons in order to prepare the students for these exams that they're subjected to almost constantly. So in other words, she could not tailor the timing or instruction to her class, you know, to the actual living human beings in her class. She had to follow the dictates of some far off committee laying down, this is where you need to be by such and such a period of time. And this is ridiculous. You cannot have an education system that's one size fits all, you know, cookie cutter, industrial assembly line sort of method of teaching, because we are, after all, talking about human beings. Human beings live and learn differently from each other. So, you know, that's why we've had teachers in the classroom, so that we can adjust to the individual needs of each particular group. So, you know, on and on I could go. I'm just getting cranked up.
So you mentioned standardized testing. And, mm-hmm. of course, with the proliferation of standardized testing, you have this phenomenon of, you know, of teaching towards the test.
Yes, exactly.
Because there's a lot of rewards and punishments based on those test scores.
Yes, exactly.
And so I think that's the best the clearest of these best known illustration of that problem. But standardized testing, I guess it dates back to the late 30s when the technology was invented with the number 2 pencil, right? If I got that
yeah,
right.
The IBM company bought a test scoring machine that was actually patented by a school teacher, and this is the beginning of it. But mm-hmm. the other philosophical underpinning to all of this standardized testing nonsense is the philosophy, basically, that was driving James Bryant Conant, the former president of Harvard University, and one of his cohorts in crime, as I like to call him, the guy that actually founded the Educational Testing Service in Princeton, a fellow by the name of Henry Chauncey. Their idea sounds good on paper. What they were trying to do was create a method to identify the really promising and gifted students so that they could slot them into special programs that were of a more advanced nature for their age group, so that they could determine the aristocracy of merit that would lead and guide the country. That's literally what they were doing. But if you stop and think about what I've just said, what they're really up to is a big social engineering project using standardized tests, quite literally, as you say, to create a system of rewards that are determined by the results on your test score. And the problem here is, as I've already pointed out, many of these test questions are prepared by people that oftentimes are less smart than the people taking the test. This is six of one, half a dozen of the other. There's really no good response to it. And, you know, the other problem here for me, you know, I'm a graduate of University of Oxford. And even as late as the 1980s, when I received my doctorate there, none of the tests at the university level were these standardized tests. Everything was essay. You had to write out your thoughts and argue your thoughts and do so with proper English diction and usage. So in other words, it was a real education, and you had real scholars in the field actually reading these exams and basically grading them. All right. This was not shipped off to a company somewhere that was run through a computer and spat out a number. So in other words, the whole mechanism, the whole mechanism of standardized tests, of using them for social engineering, this is the problem.
Now, of course, going further back into history, perhaps the 19th century, we have this phenomenon of so-called progressive education and also the imposition of compulsory education.
Right. Now,
this has been cited as sort of the backbone of democracy and educated populace and these things. But, of course, the motivations behind these things were much more nefarious than we're generally told, because it was designed to create sort of this cookie cutter or a standardized approach for the oligarchs then. Now, do you want to get into the history of some of these educational reformers and who was paying them and why they're promoting some of their ideas?
Well, there was an excellent little book that was published by Paoli or something. I can't even remember the name right off the top of my head. A tiny little book called The Leipzig Connection, but it caused quite a stir in the 70s and 80s when it came out, because basically it documented where all of this is coming from. It's all coming from Germany. And one psychologist professor at the University of Leipzig by the name of Wilhelm Wundt. Now, this guy had the idea to put psychology onto a quote-unquote scientific footing, and that meant that it had to be mathematized, made a study of statistics. And in order to do that, what he did was he completely bought into the idea that was so current in the Victorian age, that mankind is essentially a material being, that everything that he thinks he's thinking or feeling is really the result of environment, material reactions in the brain, chemical reactions, and so on and so forth. So he developed a psychology lab where he was testing these theories. And basically, he viewed, because of this materialist philosophy, he viewed mankind as a stimulus response mechanism. So in other words, it's from Wilhelm Wundt that you get Pavlov in Russia with, you know, his dogs and the experiment with the bell and salivating at the sound of the bell and so on. He also taught, as a matter of course, a number of American educators, people like John Dewey. His influence reaches from people like Dewey or Thorndike and people like this all throughout the early stages of 19th century American education. So this philosophy's had a profound influence, because what in effect it did was it reduced the teacher to a practitioner of psychology. In other words, the teacher's role wasn't so much to teach a subject as it was to provide an environment in which the latest theory could be used to educate students. So in other words, think of the teacher in this philosophy as a kind of a paralegal, someone licensed to do certain things that a full psychologist does or a psychiatrist does now in the modern American school as a kind of extension of that profession. So the emphasis, you'll notice, is shifting from the content of the subject and tailoring pedagogy to an individual group of students to a massive cookie cutter sort of situation where the teacher has to be a licensee in the latest methods and theories. All right. So in other words, this is where you see the transition from content to method. This is why teachers began to have to be licensed, get a teaching certificate. And, you know, to drive this point home, you know, I have a PhD from the oldest university in the English-speaking world, and yet I cannot get up in a public high school classroom and teach history because I lack that, quote-unquote, training in the latest pedagogical methods. This is the heart of the problem, because what that in turn does is it empowers that elite within the teachers' colleges who are, you know, progressivists to a man and a woman, to continue their experimentation in social engineering in the guise of education. This is precisely the problem.
What you're referring to, this is the Prussian model?
Prussian? Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Imagine the United States of America, supposedly a democratic republic, adopting the educational methods of Imperial Germany. You know, it just kind of boggles the mind when you get right down to it.
Yeah, the United States, if you look at throughout our history, we've been invaded by various bad ideas from Europe. We just don't know it. That's
yeah, so true. And, you know, this has to be one of the baddest ideas that's ever come out of anywhere.
Yeah, I can imagine the powers that be being very upset with someone of the likes of you in a classroom. You're very dangerous. So.
Well, yeah, you know, anybody that has had exposure to a traditional academic education is really a danger to these people, because you immediately see through all the methodological gobbledygook.
Mm-hmm.
My response to it is simply to dismiss it and ignore it. I've never paid any attention to it. I think it's useless and unnecessary. It's produced a bumper crop of stupid people that spend more time learning educational theory, pedagogy, psychology, and all that claptrap than they spend learning the subjects that they're supposed to teach. This is the other, you know, we're back to my question of the student, you know, name five provisions of the Treaty of Versailles, and she can't even spell Versailles correctly. Mm-hmm.
if you said Versailles, she'd be closer to that. It's the way I pronounced it, like in the fifth grade when I came across a history book, and I was immediately corrected. It's Versailles, it's French. Okay, since then I've been pronouncing it Versailles. But then again, I wasn't in college. I was in the fifth grade reading a history book about the First World War. You know, right. Precocious youth that I was. But here we have in the 19th century, the I think 1840s, 1850s, and then I guess the New England states.
Right.
You have the development, this idea of compulsory education. And prior to that, most education was, well, it was local community. It was, I guess, generally private. It was kind of like the community did it. One-room schoolhouse. And this was producing a lot of independent, you know, a lot of back then people were independently employed, mostly farmers, some tinkers, small industry.
Right.
So it was developing a population in America, which you could say was very independent-minded and well-read. I mean, literate.
Yes, very. Even,
much better than today's standards because...
Oh, yes.
What people don't know is reading is that the whole idea of compulsory education was to reverse that, to arrest that development, to turn a nation of independent, you know, business owners and farmers and turn thinkers into workers, as someone once said.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. So, well, that was John D. Rockefeller's statement himself, you know, when he set up the General Education Board with Rockefeller Foundation money, was that he didn't need people that could think. He needed workers. In other words, he needed worker bees and consumers of his products. So the other thing that, that modern American education does is it's part and parcel of our consumerist materialist culture. The philosophy is built into all of this right at the outset. And the other thing, since you mentioned compulsory education, we can go back and look at Horace Mann for just a minute, because when he starts this experiment in Massachusetts, one of his goals is precisely to empower a permanent educational bureaucracy, which we've certainly got now. And the way to do this was to come up with a set of standards and then, you know, an abstract set of standards that are really not derived from any sort of genuine empirical contact with students or teachers. And then when you start to notice failures, you blame it on, guess who? The teacher. So that means we have to have more money, we have to have more funding, we have to have more training. That's always a key component of all of this, is continued training of teachers in the latest theory that the educators are coming up with. And the result is a constant continuous failure and a constant plea for more money and so on and so forth. And the problem is all of the emphasis once again has shifted away from content into methodology, be it standardized tests, teacher certification, what have you. This is all a huge, huge complex. And for my part, I'll have to be honest with you, Tim, I'm in full agreement with John Taylor Gatto, you know, the American teacher that just kind of broke ranks completely with the whole educational system and came right out and said, there's no fixing the system. The system is the problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've got this one size fits all mentality. One of the biggest things that happened as a result of this whole educational philosophy is slotting people into age groups, you know, junior, senior. There's no more one-room schoolhouse where you have children in the second or third grade being taught by one teacher and mixing and mingling with children in the sixth through the ninth grade or what have you,
mm-hmm.
which is psychologically, if you stop and think about it, psychologically, that's not the way society is organized. So, you know, they miss the interaction of learning to live with people older or younger than their age group. And then we expect them to come out normal at the end of this whole process.
Yeah, you can't create an insane system and expect people to emerge with their sanity.
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. Of course, when their sanity does manifest itself, you pathologize it and you give them Ritalin or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Which is
You know, this is an important point. Let's go back to what I said about teacher certification as being a license to practice as kind of a parapsychologist, because it's the teachers now that are required to point out to school officials whether they think a child needs drugs. Well, you know, come on here.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I defy anybody to say that you know, average behavior of a boy is an example of ADHD. You know, that certainly does exist, but to the extent that we've been drugging little boys in our school system, no, you know, this is nuts.
Yeah, and there's always the question, whether if someone does have ADHD, is the answer pharmacology? You know,
yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
It could be other things. You know, yeah, it could be something in his life, in his home life.
Well, I'll be very blunt here again. In my experience in the college classroom, if I taught at a genuinely collegiate level, which I attempted to do all the time, there was no room for people to be bored. And I think this is the other problem in our school system.
Mm-hmm.
Our children are much more intelligent than we give them credit for. And they're much more capable of learning things at a much faster pace than we're doing. So they end up being bored. And what do? Well, they act out. You know, look at Japan. Japan is training children at the ages of 4 or 5 or 6 to play classical violin, mm-hmm. you know, classical piano, and so on and so forth. In Europe, you start learning a foreign language in elementary school, and, you know, it's not put off until high school. So, in other words, we have even that. We have that kind of bass-ackward, if I can be a little French in my expression. it's just a sweepingly inefficient, fraudulent, and I will use that word, fraudulent system, because it is not delivering the product that it claims that it is. And mm-hmm. I say that, Tim, of the whole system from kindergarten through college and graduate school. This country's academic educational system is fraudulent. It is a complete sham.
Now, one way is that the system, or at least one way that people do manage to get educated in this country is through violating the rules, breaking, yes. getting outside the system. You mentioned John Taylor Gatto.
Yeah.
Now, if I recall from his story, was he started teaching using someone else's license.
Well, that may be, you know, that may be. And if that's the case, more power to him,
yeah.
because, you know, he's received numerous awards.
Yes.
And, my co-author is what I like to call, and I've talked to numerous teachers that have had this very same experience, that they deliberately make the choice to be a subversive in the system.
Mm-hmm.
They are teaching to the best of their ability, to the extent that they are able and allowed within the time that they have to do so, in traditional content-based interaction with the students and having them, you know, write out answers rather than simply fill in ovals on a standardized test. Mm-hmm. In other words, they're deliberately bucking the system, and there are students. And I've seen this again with my own eyes. My friend Scott DeHart is a teacher in a public school system out in California. And I have been in his classes. And you can tell that there are students, and oftentimes they will come up and say this to him, that there are students that can tell the difference between what they're getting from him. And again, you know, he's a fellow Oxford grad and has very traditional notions about pedagogy. You can tell the student response that they realize that they're getting something different and unique that they don't get from very many other teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear this over and over and over again from teachers. I've got many teachers that are members of my website. They say the same thing, that they're in it for as long as they can stand it, and they're in it to be subversive of the system. And, you know, that's a horrible, if you stop and think about it, that's a horrible thing to put any professional, be they a teacher, a doctor, whatever, to put a person in where you are knowingly and deliberately violating what the state has said to do.
Yes.
But this is precisely the problem, because what the state is requiring people to do is nuts. It's just Looney Tunes. It's all being designed for the big corporations and the oligarchs, as you said, and to dumb people down and make them good, happy little worker bee consumers,
mm-hmm.
rather than critical thinkers.
Now, another point I think is that's worth making here is that one of the more promising developments in real education in this country is the growing homeschooling movement, which,
right.
again, was born in out of illegality. People just walked away from the schools, and
right.
so we're not participating anymore. And so many people did it that the system could not stop it. They could try to regulate it. They could harass a few
right.
people. But now it's gotten so big that they can't really openly suppress it anymore. And it's become more normalized as the system has gotten worse.
Well, it's not only going to increase. I think it's going to increase to the point, and you know, I have people asking me all the time, what should I do? Should I send my kids to college or not? And I tell them, don't send them to an American college.
Mm-hmm.
If you can afford it, send them overseas. Send them to Russia, for crying out loud, or they don't put up with this nonsense. It's to that point. And the other problem here, Tim, is we've also got to factor in government money. because just like healthcare, government money injected into the system has only driven up costs astronomically. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the modern American university, be it Harvard, Stanford, whatever, what you see is a bunch of administrators that are drawing in hundreds of thousands of dollars in their salaries, which is helping drive up the costs of education. You know, I got my PhD for about $24,000. That would be impossible in today's world. It would be at least an order of magnitude more to do this. So you're saddling students that are coming out of the college system after they've been indoctrinated with all of this progressivist nonsense with hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt and no jobs.
Yes, they're setting up – it's predatory lending, and at the same time they're being indoctrinated with a philosophy. They're not going to be able to even understand what's been done to them. You mentioned it's interesting that you mention it because you said education and with medicine. These two systems are harvesting systems. And
yes,
also
they're
also a way to put everyone in the debt. But
the
two are very interesting. In your book, you show how the two are, how the cartelization of these two industries or professions are key to technocracy. And of course, the one Abraham Flexner played a role in both of them, right?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
Flexner was another one of these people that was heavily influenced by this whole philosophy, psychology that was coming out of Wilhelm Wundt and the University of Leipzig. And what I really get a kick out of is that Flexner decided he was going to put all of this wonderful philosophy into effect with a progressive school. And he decided that he was going to name it the Lincoln School because everybody, you know, with Honest Abe and all that.
Yeah,
if you know anything about the history of Abraham Lincoln, he was hardly anything but honest. But anyway,
yeah. But that's history, right?
But that's history. We don't want to go there. You know, don't trouble us with the facts. All we need is ideology.
In a standardized test to say
Abe, in a standardized test,
he'd be Honest Abe, right? So he'd have to be
exactly. Exactly. You know, don't talk about his suspension of writ of habeas corpus. Don't talk about the fact that he was not in favor of freeing the slaves and shipping them all back to Africa after the end of the Civil War. You know, let's not go there. But
and also, he also wasn't 25 feet tall like in the memorial in Washington.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, you know, it says a lot that they build Jefferson's memorial over by a pond, kind of out of the way, you know, but they build this big, you know, mausoleum temple for Lincoln.
The Greek god. Yeah.
Yeah, the Greek god Lincoln. But anyway, Flexner opens up this Lincoln School. And of course, the emphasis again is on not on producing people that know the content of the necessary disciplines, but rather on making good citizens, okay? Mm-hmm. And in that, he's following very definitely the philosophy of John Dewey, another one of these progressivist educators. And the Rockefeller patriarch at the time, John D. Jr., decided to send his sons to this school. And I just love this because it's a classic example of what I've said so many times in interviews, that the elite, by surrounding themselves with people that think exactly like they do, can't think in any other way. In other words, they can't think their way out of a paper bag.
Mm-hmm.
When you surround people that agree with you all the time or can't think or articulate an opposing point of view with rationality and clarity, then you end up with an elite that's really kind of ossified and incapable of adapting. You know, we're watching this happen right now today, you know, in the United States. So he sends his sons, Lawrence and David and Nelson Aldrich, to this Lincoln School that Flexner comes up with. And it's interesting that all of these Rockefeller boys come out of that school not enjoying reading a book. And in fact, Nelson Rockefeller, we point this out in the book, Nelson Rockefeller complained that he found reading tedious. He didn't like to do it. Now, This guy goes on to end up being a presidential advisor to Eisenhower during World War II. He's an intelligence officer for Latin America. He ends up, of course, being vice president under Gerald Ford. And he doesn't like to read. Mm-hmm. You know? Now, this is not somebody I want to have in charge of the country or anywhere close to it. So, you know, and this is repeated over and over. This is a pattern that's repeated over and over in these progressive education.
Yeah, yeah. And reading is fundamental to higher order thinking.
It's not only fundamental to higher order thinking, but the other problem that we have now in this country is this whole technocracy idea that everything that you need to know is on the internet.
Yes.
You know, which is nuts, because, you know, anybody that reads my books knows that most of the sources that I use in my books are not on the internet. Mm-hmm. You have to go out and dig in libraries and find the books and look up the page number, you know, all that good stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's this whole system, Tim, I have nothing good to say about it, as you can probably tell.
Well, they're digitizing everything, which, the lure there is that it's immediately attractive because it appears to be very convenient. But we put up with inconveniences in life out of a matter of concern or safety or security. A good example is it's very inconvenient to have a lock on my door.
Right.
But I lock it, I painstakingly go through the effort of unlocking it and locking it when I enter my house because I'm aware that there's a dangerous world outside. It's the same thing with books and original text, physical copies of books, is these things.
Right.
Things that cannot be altered. Obviously,
digital device. I'm so glad you said that.
No, I mean, this whole cloud phenomenon is driving me nuts because it does me too.
And I mean, Tim, I got to tell you, you've pointed out what for me is the primary difficulty with all of this cloud stuff. You know, I call it the Soviet encyclopedia phenomenon. Uh-huh. If you're familiar with the history of the Soviet encyclopedias, you can go and look up different editions. And in some editions, you'll see a picture of Joseph Stalin and Yagoda and Yezhov, you know, the two intelligence guys, both of whom he had liquidated at some point. Mm-hmm. So in different versions of the Soviet encyclopedia, you know, they crop the photos, you know, well, here's Stalin and Yagoda, or here's Stalin and Yezhov, and you know, depending on which copy you're dealing with, that everything can be altered. Well, now move that to the cloud. All you need to do to alter a text that is offensive to your political or cultural agenda is to push a button and delete a few phrases or add a few words of your own to the text. I tell all of my readers that the only canonical copy of my books is the printed page, not Kindle, not Nook, not any electronic form, because I do not trust these corporations to be safeguards of my thoughts and my words.
That's right.
And that's the, you know, period. End of discussion, no negotiation.
And there is, I mean... There's an aesthetic quality to a book itself. When I read a book on an electronic device, I get a lot less out of it when it's in my lap, a physical copy. It just
actually been a phenomenon that they have studied, that psychologists and sociologists have studied, and for some reason, people do seem to retain more from a book, from a physical book. Mm-hmm. For some reason, we don't know why. I suspect it has something to do with the scanning rates on computer monitors and so on and so forth. But that is true. It's getting to the point that we have to understand that there are certain things that technology cannot do. It can't replace a human being in the classroom mentoring students and tailoring lessons and content to their individual specific needs. This, you know, this one size fits all method and model simply isn't working.
Yeah. And also another aesthetic quality of a book is if you walk into someone's a well-read person, he's a library and he has all these books on the shelf.
Right.
And I read these books. It's not, you're not going to pull out your Kindle and go, look, I read all these books.
Yeah, exactly.
But I mean, there's a practical meaning to that because, again, that book is there. It's physical. It cannot be altered. I think it was first time I even thought about it was Kindle, which is, I'm going to say it's a wonderfully convenient device. I do use it for a lot of material. I have to admit, I do. But yeah, I'm putting these things in perspective. It was Richard Grove at Tragedy and Hope who said, they named it Kindle for a reason. What are you burning books with?
You're burning books. Exactly.
Yeah,
burning books.
Yeah.
And you're empowering a corporation with a virtual monopoly over, or at least a cartel, over the information and texts that people are producing.
Mm-hmm.
So, I totally agree with you. It's about book burning. And, that reminds me of, I think it was the German poet Heine or Schiller, I forget which one it was, that said, where books are burnt, people are burnt.
Mm-hmm. And at least burning physically burning books, that's labor intensive. They got to make an effort at least.
Yeah, exactly.
With electronic devices, no one will even know about it.
Right.
Now, we mentioned, connection between Abraham Flexner. Of course, he produced a Flexner report, which cartelized much of America's, I guess, fledgling medical profession back in the early 20th century.
Right, exactly.
And there was some argument for it because there were some questions of quality and there's some argument for standardization. But it also imposed Rockefeller allopathic medicine.
Yes, it did.
Marginalized other disciplines or approaches, which
everything became
dependent on, petrochemically based medicine, surgery, these things.
Yes.
Which, again, has its benefits. It also has its major drawbacks. But bring it forward to today, because this comes up in your book, Rotten to the Core, is the, of course, it's not a coincidence that Obamacare was instituted or imposed unconstitutionally, by the way, at the same time Common Core, because it's all part it's all part of the same thing, right?
Well, I think you said it best earlier, and I agree with you. How is a law legal when the Speaker of the House gets up and tells everybody, well, to find out what's in it, we have to pass it?
Yes.
I'm of the opinion that nothing should be a law unless the congressmen have actually sat down and read it. The Founding Fathers created the Constitution for this country on a few pages of paper in plain English that everybody could understand. And now we've got lawyers involved in all of this, and it's become a horrendous process that gets more complex and more complicated and more removed from reality, just like our stock markets and commodities markets. We've got computers running everything, so it doesn't even reflect actual human activity or market. So the problem here, as far as I'm concerned, and you said it very well earlier, this is a mechanism to harvest people's wealth. That's all it is.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing, healthcare was one of the last, or as I prefer to call it, sick care, because it tends to make people sicker than they,
That's a business model, the Rockefeller medicine, yep.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's the business model. And it's a method of harvesting wealth from people. And the education system is yet the other big way, because by empowering certain corporations, and again, this is the problem with Common Core, isn't so much the idea of a standard of content. The problem is the assessment process, because who is gaining monetarily from this? Well, it's a very, very few corporations that are involved in preparing these standardized tests and then supplying the schools with the computers and their special programs and their special textbooks to go with it. So, this is a huge monetary scam to enrich these corporations. Nothing more and nothing less.
And Catherine Austin Fitz writes, as she writes in the foreword, she came to that realization that she was talking to a political consultant, in the Bush campaign. And she found, why was he so excited about this? I think it was the No Child Left Behind Act, which is a stepping stone to Common Core.
Right.
The two most significant economic activities in approximately 3,100 counties that make up America are healthcare and education, is what we're talking about.
That's right.
Not coincidentally, healthcare practitioners and teachers represent two major aspects of what remains of the U.S. middle class. Federal mandates are requiring the healthcare records be digitized, there goes our privacy, right? Into the cloud, right?
Right.
While the Affordable Health Care Act is essentially shifting healthcare financial flows into corporate hands.
Right.
Digitization of records and standardization of treatment will permit more than $1 trillion in labor costs to be squeezed out of the healthcare sector. This has produced quite a windfall for corporate equities as healthcare had the lead U.S. stock market outperform global markets for several years.
Yep.
The same process is being carried under the mandates of Common Core. That's a great connection that she draws there.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And the other thing is digitizing health records is subject to the same caveats that we spoke of before about digitizing books, because you can go in and alter a person's charts. You can falsify them and so on and so forth.
Blackmail.
Precisely. Yeah.
There's a reason why your file was paper tucked away in a cabinet locked in a doctor's office. Wasn't because they were old fashioned. They were Luddites.
Right.
There was safety in that decentralized approach. Again, you can argue that a certain level of inefficiency existed, but then again, a certain level of inefficiency exists in the idea of divided powers in the Constitution.
I'll tell you what the trend is with digitizing records and so on. When the healthcare bill passed, what it really was a step towards reducing you to collateral and chattel status. And I realized that, I was saying this at the time, that, there's no way I will allow the federal government sovereignty over my body and my life and my DNA.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just last week, somebody emailed me an article about, one of the Kennedys, I think the son of Senator Kennedy, is a state senator in Connecticut, has proposed a bill in Connecticut that the state own your organs when you die, and you have to opt out of that system rather than opt in as an organ donor.
This is for organ harvesting.
Bingo.
By the way, they cannot pull organs out of a dead person.
That I know. I know. So you stop and do the math here. Mm-hmm. Digitized health records.
Oh boy.
Compulsory organ donation and harvesting of your body's organs. This is a nightmare, inhuman, anti-human system that they are trying to impose.
Yeah, because if let's say you're an octogenarian oligarch and you want a heart, and all of a sudden the system locates a 16-year-old athlete, right?
Yeah, exactly.
All of a sudden he gets a head injury.
Yeah,
this is the logic of the system.
It's like the old what they're doing is they're setting up the old movie Coma with Michael Douglas and Genevieve Bujold, which was a movie precisely about illegally harvesting people's organs by literally killing them on the operating table, having medical accidents or what have you.
It's a little off topic, but it's related, of course, because it all is.
It's related to Common Core because it's the same sort of philosophy of the reduction of man to a simple source of material.
I just listened to an interview, I got to mention this, about a lady's son was 16 years old in the late 90s, and he was he shot himself in the head, apparently accidentally, from what I understand. Mm-hmm. So they called the emergency. EMS showed up within 5 minutes or 15 minutes. The ambulance took him to the hospital. They got to the hospital, and the doctor says, "We nothing we can do for him." Father protests, "Do everything you can for him. I'll try just for you." So the doctor goes back, tries. Another hour goes by, says, "We can't save him." Then they have him sign the release forms for the organs.
Yep.
Well, let's just make a long story short. They found out that in the ambulance, they tried to intubate him, and they had to drug him to keep him from resisting, meaning he was conscious.
Right.
They told the parents he was out.
Yep.
And they gave him so the parents left, thought their son was dead. The 16-year-old son was dead. Then what they found out subsequently is that he was kept alive for 19 hours, drugged, He was more or less drugs was were used to paralyze him.
Yep.
And they kept him alive so they could harvest the organs.
Yep.
But then the point is he got better care to keep him alive than he did in the emergency room solely for harvesting organs. And the doctor on the show said it's very likely he could have been saved and very likely he could fully recover from that. But the problem is because he was 16 years old and the human body is worth anywhere from $1 to $5 million with organs.
Right.
Believe me, the psychopaths who run the financial system, the people who commodify everything, human life, everything, our DNA, have no qualms about making that cold rationale. It's very rational. It's very scientific, you know. So this is where it leads. You're right. Exactly. And this is the system. And what's chilling about that is that the EMS technicians are being trained to do this. Oh, 16-year-old, head injury, not much chance of survival, or if he does survive, he'll be handicapped, not worth as much. See?
Right.
And so this is the system we're leading to. You might be interested. You're familiar with Neil Postman?
Not really.
Well, he wrote Entertaining Ourselves to Death. He's a big guy and critic of technology. And I was listening to a lecture. He was talking about the lecture he gave was in the late 90s. But he was talking about New York City public schools and the time when they were digitizing. They were wiring the schools into the internet back then. And at the time, there were 1.1 million students in the school system, and 90,000 didn't have classrooms to go into at the time. But they were spending millions on wiring the schools to the internet.
Right.
And but his point, he mentioned an article in the June 11th Washington Post, 1996, where Maryland Governor Paris Glendening announced a $53 million plan to connect every classroom in Maryland public schools to the internet, to give students access to the far-flung information provided by the internet. Tens of million dollars would also be donated by private industry, the total expenditure around $100 million. But then Governor Glendening, the then governor, said, accessing information is the first vital step in understanding and ultimately improving the world we live in. And Postman called this errant nonsense. He said, American students already had an oversupply of sources of information, 17,000 newspapers, 12,000 periodicals, 27,000 video outlets they could rent videos from, 500 million TV sets in the country, 600 million radios, not including cars, 10,000 libraries, and 40,000 new books published every year. And he just asked the question, do American students now require an additional $100 million investment to provide an access to information? This is sort of this fetish towards technology is, I think what you're getting is not only is it a corporatist scam to increase private profits at public expense, which is an old scam, but there's also a sort of a technocratic method here to fundamentally change the who we are. It's sort of a reverse alchemical process, right?
It's an effort to fundamentally change the way that people conceive of academic research. You and I grew up in an era where we had to learn how to use a library.
Mm-hmm.
You know, go in, look things up in the card catalog. We had to be familiar with Dewey Decimal and Library of Congress systems of organizing a library and understand where to go to find certain types of information. And, you know, as I've said earlier, not all information is on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to know how to use a library if you are going to do serious academic research. There are papers and so on that are still not uploaded to the internet, you know, in physics, biology, chemistry, and so on. So this becomes a huge problem, particularly for people like me that are interested in history. You know, old texts are things that are not digitized too easily. And there's so much of it out there that it's going to be a very long time before it is. So I'm in total agreement with you here. This is nothing but another technocratic scam to change the way people perceive information and get information. There's nothing good to say about this system. Technology is not the be-all and end-all. If you allow it to remove the human element from the equation, this is an inhuman system that they're putting into place, and I would argue that ultimately it's an anti-human system.
Mm-hmm. In the book, you also mentioned you devoted a chapter to the role of the tax-free foundations.
Oh, boy. Yeah. They have played a huge role in this development. In fact, if you look at that era, I talk a lot about the Reese Committee in that mm-hmm. book. This was a committee that was set up when the Republicans took over in the first Eisenhower administration, when they took over Congress. And again, you know, Republicans being Republicans, they didn't do anything, but you know, even with their majority.
Some things never change.
Yeah, some things never change. But the interesting thing was this committee took over from a Democratic committee that had been appointed by the Democrats when they had the majority in the House.
Was it
the
Cox?
Yeah, the Cox Committee, yeah. So in other words, you know, there were people in the House that were wondering, you know, just what's going on with these foundations. And there's a marvelous book out, if people don't know it. It's called Foundations, Their Power and Influence. It's written by a gentleman by the name of René Wormser. He was the chief counsel to the Reese Committee investigating foundations. And he made a very powerful, I think, and very significant observation that what these foundations are, Rockefeller, Carnegie, and so on, what these foundations really are is the modern equivalent of the old medieval orders like the Templars. Why? Because, like the Templars, they have been given tax-exempt status. So what the Templars did, what they used that tax-exempt status for, was they were able to accumulate intergenerational capital under the control of the order. So look at the foundations. They're tax exempt, and what they in effect do is allow the very wealthy to retain control over how their wealth is used while avoiding taxes. Yes. By turning it over to a foundation. So these become tremendously powerful instruments to drive agendas that they want driven into the public, which certainly you can see in the case of the Rockefeller Foundation, their General Education Board. You can mm-hmm. see it in the Carnegie Endowment for World Peace and so on. Now, the interesting thing, to put this in a much wider context, I made the observation in another one of my books called The Third Way, that if you look at that period of American history, there's something very, very peculiar going on in the Congress. You've got all of these committees investigating some aspect of penetration of the federal government. We tend to think, obviously, of Senator McCarthy, you know, mm-hmm. the familiar name. But you have the Reese Committee doing this in a different way. You have the Kefauver Committee doing this with the mafia and the mob and so on. You've got all of these committees somehow responding to this perceived interior domestic threat. And what amazes me, Tim, is with all of this activity going on, no scholar that I'm aware of has ever attempted to sit down and investigate that phenomenon whole. In other words, we have studies of McCarthy, we have studies of Kefauver and Reese and all of this, but they're done in isolation from each other. No one has yet attempted to explain why this sudden congressional interest in finding out, you know, what sort of influences domestically are there within the federal government and where is yes. it coming from.
Yeah.
This is an important thing, I think, that needs to be done. There may not be, you know, any such thing, but, you know, we aren't going to know until it's researched in a thorough and scholarly fashion.
Yeah, because both Reese and also McCarthy, although he jawboned the issue,
right.
they were kind of put up to it, and maybe different, yes. different factions were battling out.
I definitely think yeah. that is the case. Yes.
Some said the FBI sicked McCarthy and the CIA, then the CIA undermined McCarthy.
Well, there is, interestingly enough, Roy Cohn, his mm-hmm. chief counsel, and then Bobby Kennedy, of course, was his assistant chief counsel. Most people don't even know that.
Yeah.
They don't connect the Kennedys, especially Bobby Kennedy, to Senator McCarthy. But
and if you go further, I mean, you mentioned Reese, and of course, that name brings up Norman Dodd. and the revelations of Catherine Casey and the Carnegie Foundation, and what she found out by going through the minutes. Maybe in a moment of absent-mindedness, they let her get access to the records, or maybe it was some sort of Freemasonic limited, you know, revelation, the method. I don't know, but she found out that there was this drawn-out plan to subject the country to a series of shocks and traumas, namely war, but maybe even economic, because you got the Great Depression and these things. This is how you fundamentally change the country, collectivize it, and ultimately to merge it, you know, with the Soviet Union, the sort of third way, usually the third way. And that she found this out, and it was so shocking to her, upsetting to her worldview, she had a nervous breakdown and could never live a normal life after that, which she found
out. Well, this is something I suspect even lays behind Dr. Carol Quigley's admission in Tragedy and Hope that he has seen the records of these people and has had access to their papers. I strongly suspect that what he's talking about is precisely access to the papers of these foundations and what they're planning. So I think there's connections galore here, but again, you know, this is something that eventually will have to be argued. But in terms of the Reese Committee, what they pointed out, and that Wormser reviews in his book, which again we review in our book, is that these foundations have exercised an inordinate amount of influence on American education, and precisely with a view to using education as a vast social engineering project to remake American society in the way they want it to be.
Yes, and you mentioned the foundations. Of course, other researchers have connected these foundations, like the Macy Foundation, the Ford Foundation, to things like MK Ultra, because now we're getting into areas of semantics. Because basically these foundations, the interests they represent, created the intelligence agencies and created much what we know of the modern world and our perception of the modern world. Because then we get in the Time Life Empire and Henry Luce and the major networks, William Parley, CBS, NBC, coming out of the Office of War Information and OSS. And all this stuff of one thing, I just finished a book called The Science of Coercion by Christopher Simpson.
Yes,
the whole notion of mass communication, its application, its refinement, and its study. This wasn't done by disinterested academics. These people were employed by the War Department to manipulate public opinion. So it was weaponized from the get-go.
Yes, it was. And this continues, of course, after World War II with Project Mockingbird, which is the literal outright CIA infiltration of the major mainstream media outlets. So this is definitely there. But you mentioned MK Ultra, and this is where I think it gets very, very interesting.
Because this is where Common Core intersects with national security state. So this is very
important. Yes, absolutely. It's very interesting to me that in the 1950s, and we mentioned this in the book, in the 1950s, the Educational Testing Service was contacted by the CIA to develop means of identifying personality types and so on and so forth. And, you know, Henry Chauncey, the founder of the Educational Testing Service, leapt at the chance. In other words, you know, he was in bed with this project right from the get-go. And we need to remember that MK Ultra was mind manipulation. This was what the whole thing was about. So factor that in here. You have someone that is making lots of money through a nonprofit corporation that does nothing but standardize tests. And he's in bed with a project that is part of the CIA's MK Ultra program. So in other words, it doesn't take much leap of the imagination to see that the standardized test is a form of mind manipulation. It's like I said earlier, it's the standardized test is really a loyalty test to a particular narrative. You're not going to find any alternative narratives being advocated or suggested in any of the questions, for example, relating to American political history or things of this sort. So I think that's a real clue right there, because in creating standardized tests as a means of social engineering, which was clearly in the mind of James Bryant Conant and clearly in the mind of Henry Chauncey, in creating these tests as means of social engineering, they also retain proprietary rights to the data that results from the tests that they give.
Mm-hmm.
And this in itself becomes a tremendous tool. This is a way of quite literally tracking you. Now, with Common Core, here's the other part of the assessment problem here. I mentioned earlier that these are individually adaptive tests. In other words, in addition to people now creating test questions regarding content, you also have psychologists involved in creating and tailoring the test questions to a particular individual. So in other words, they're gathering psychological profiles. And the final clincher here is that if the Common Core system were to be implemented now, say overnight, you would be subject to standardized testing all the way from elementary school through your baccalaureate degree. So in other words, this is a way of tracking you and gathering data on your personal likes, your dislikes. We already see this happening now with Amazon and some of these big online Internet of Things companies. But just imagine this at the national scale with a database of every person in the country in the school system from kindergarten to college. This gives you an enormous amount of power. And frankly, it's power that I do not want to see any cartel, any corporation, or the federal government having. This is also the ultimate insider traders mechanism, because with that information, you can make an enormous pile of money just predicting market behaviors and so on and so forth. So this is all an interlocked, nightmarish system that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Knowledge is power. Information is power.
Exactly.
I think it was a while back, the Onion did a thing on Facebook, and they had a guy from the CIA and NSA there saying that we used to have to spend billions of dollars tracking, surveilling people, gathering information. Mm-hmm. Now people just giving their information up for free.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
And of course, Facebook itself has ties back to the CIA, I think, indirectly through InQtel.
Yes. This has all been a very carefully thought out, premeditated design system, including the social media. I'm absolutely in agreement with that.
Of course, I mentioned Facebook, and I remember reading a while back that Zuckerberg had opened up created his own foundation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course, this is what they do. You know, they get to a certain period where they're part of the 1%, and in order to protect their wealth, they slot it into these tax-free foundations, where actually you have a multiplier effect on that wealth, because now they can influence things in the guise of philanthropy. This isn't philanthropy. You know, we need to start doing what the progressives have always done and start tailoring our language appropriately. Calling them philanthropic organizations is absolutely not the case. These are quite literally lobby groups, tax-free lobby groups, to drive certain agendas. But they're not philanthropic in any classical sense of that word.
Well, in many respects, it's misanthropy masquerading as philanthropy.
Exactly.
Philanthropy.
We can call them misanthropic foundations.
Because if you look at it, I mean, again, you talk about leveraging that financial power to take over the culture.
Right.
They sponsor, I mean, something like the arts, where it's very easy to corrupt if you have enough money, because the arts itself takes an incredible amount of resources and time to refine, to develop classical art. Good art, you know.
Good art, yeah.
Real art.
Believe me, I have been on the culture art bandwagon recently in a major way, because you look at, for example, David Rockefeller, who just recently died. You look at the so-called art that he sponsored, and it's manifestly ugly.
Yeah, it's
all this modern art crap, and
it's aesthetic violence.
It's aesthetic violence.
Yeah,
you know, and that, you know, I just did a webinar on my website where I told people that the effect of modern art is Marxist in nature, because all human response to this stuff is made equal. You're made equal in your response to abject ugliness. Mm-hmm. And we need to remember also that the CIA, again, was a major sponsor of a lot of this modern art, modern music, and so on and so forth.
Atonal, Schoenberg?
Schoenberg. Not necessarily so much Schoenberg. He was supported by the Frankfurt School of Critics. But yeah, Schoenberg, you know, you can listen to about 3 seconds of that stuff before you go absolutely nuts. It's just so appallingly ugly. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this again is part of the agenda to drive people away from their traditional aesthetic moorings and to accept the pronouncements of so-called academia that this stuff is really wonderful. There, you know, since you mentioned art, I want to mention to your readers to do something. Go online on YouTube and Google the question, why is modern art so bad? This is about a 5-minute little tour by a professor of art at Prager University, and I'm not even going to ruin it for people. You just have to watch it and see what this guy does. But you can also go online and Google on YouTube, search for the piano pieces of Arnold Schoenberg. Just listen to about 5 seconds of that, and then search for Nora the Cat. This is a little cat, female cat, that sits up on her mistress's piano bench and plays the piano, just plucks the keys with her paws. And I defy anybody to find much difference between Arnold Schoenberg and Nora the Cat.
That's part of, I guess you could say, the Frankfurt deconstruction approach.
Yes, exactly what this is. And we need to remember that the people in the Frankfurt School were Marxists to a man.
Yeah, and also malevolent. I mean, that's not
totally.
It isn't free thinking. It's malevolency at work here.
Yes,
It's. I mean, part of this is breaking everything down, I guess, because these different cultures, ethnicities, these things, traditions, this gets back to standardization, I guess, gets back to for globalism, because if you break everything down, then you can standardize everything, and we're seeing that all across the globe.
When you break everything down, what you're really doing is you're breaking it down in order that you can substitute a completely artificial order and keep certain people in power.
Yeah,
this is precisely the problem, because the traditional approach to education, the traditional approach to the arts and so on, recognizes unique genius, recognizes the individual, recognizes individual creativity, and by that same token, responsibility. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is an assault on the individual person, regardless of what tradition or background you come from, culturally, you know, Spanish, French, whatever. That's what all of this is about. So they sponsor ugliness. And, you know, I genuinely think in David Rockefeller's case, I had a friend actually many years ago that worked for him and, you know, was in his office frequently and told me that there was all this ugly modern art. Well, that's a reflection to a certain extent of what's in the soul.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this was an ugly man. I'm sorry. That's what he was. He wore that on his face. You can see it on his face, that internal ugliness. They don't know anything else other than that. And, you know, that's what they're exposed to with Flexner and his wonderful Lincoln School.
Mm-hmm.
That good stuff.
Well, I understand he might have been uploaded. His consciousness might have been uploaded to the mothership, so...
Now he's
living the life eternal. I don't know.
Well, good luck to the aliens in control of the mothership. You know, I saw a funny cartoon, since you mentioned that, of Rockefeller, you know, arriving in hell with a big bag of money, and a lady is informing the devil that he wants to fund a new underworld order. And so, you know, I'm not saying that he ended up in hell, but it certainly is a provocative commentary.
Yeah, it's just like not for us to just. Luckily, that decision isn't mine to make.
It isn't mine to make either.
Yeah, so, again, he was, I don't know, born into an evil family. So we're getting back to this whole thing with education, is the entire agenda again. Well, is I mean, how would you sum this up? How would you incorporate this work in some of your other work to close out the interview? How's the best way to?
Well, for me, the book fits into all the rest because basically what I've been trying to detail through all the books is that there is a group of people, always has been, that view themselves as the masters of the universe, and they have no allegiance whatsoever to anything that is remotely humanizing. And this is why I think culture right now is far more important than politics. We are looking at people that are trying desperately to drive the world into an inhuman and anti-human state of affairs, and to reduce everybody to, you know, despair, hopelessness, ugliness. We certainly see the ugliness right now in contemporary American society and politics. This is what they're about. And ultimately, it cannot succeed because the reality of things is that human beings are human beings. We are creatures that are born to love and have compassion and contemplate the sublime and beautiful and so on and so forth. And they're against that. So the response to it has to be detailed, well thought out, and long term. It has to be a cultural response. I go back to the fact that the Italian communist philosopher Antonio Gramsci made a very, very important conclusion. And his conclusion was that Marxism would never work by the conventional approach of economic leveling and so on. It had to be a cultural leveling. It had to occur in the intellectual realm, it had to occur in literature, it had to occur in the arts. And the way to do this was to be anti-traditional in every conceivable way that they could be, and that would drive the revolution. So, you know, he was a very far, you know, far ahead of his time in the sense that, you know, in a certain sense, he's kind of the godfather or grandfather of today's social justice warriors and activists and so on, because this is their game plan.
This is the long march to the institutions.
This is the long march through the institutions, precisely.
And we see it so, I mean, it's in our face in the universities.
Oh, yes.
In Hollywood, in the media. Everything is just constant, one assault after another. It's like they're beating over the head with it now.
Yeah.
The transgenderism and the gay rights and the sex and the everything is just, there's no respite. And they're literally gunning. I mean, I have children of my own, and they're being targeted by them. And you have to take positive. I mean, you just can't sit back. And there was a time when most Americans sit back, and although I don't think this was true in the 50s, but it seemed to appeal that way, that the general culture was more hospitable to the child's development. Now it's openly hostile. And if you are a parent and you're passively sitting, but you can't assume that the institutions that we're forced to pay and support and that we inherit, we can't assume that those institutions are benevolent or, you know, benign. No. They're malevolent, and it's the public schools, it's the university system, it's the entertainment media. I mean, it really is full spectrum dominance. I mean,
it really is, and we have to assume much more critical and discreet attitudes than currently we are doing.
Mm-hmm.
This is, like you say, it's a full scale assault. It's a full scale, full spectrum dominance of the culture. And, you know, the way to fight it is simply not to go along with it. Don't use their gender neutral pronouns, and, you know, insist that gender is different than sex. You know,
yes.
To me, the most fascinating thing.
Make that. I'm so glad you made that point, because that's always bothered the hell out of me.
Well, you know,
you said gender.
Gender is a linguistic property of languages. It's, you know, it's got to do with words, not gonads, quite literally, I can put it bluntly. But, you know, you watch this change, you know, you used to fill out forms back in the 70s and 80s, and, you know, what was your sex, male or female?
Mm-hmm.
And now it's, what is your gender? And, of course, that's the whole spectrum. You know, there's more genders than there are colors in the rainbow anymore. But it's all of this linguistic tinkering. And, you know, the way to fight it is, number one, stop using it and recognizing that, for these people, assent to their usage or their contrived artificial conventions, be it in literature or the arts or whatever, is assent to the method.
Yes.
And it's assent to the agenda. That's why they are trying to force people to use these conventions, because that represents your capitulation. So, you know, it's time for us to start saying no, and we have to fully understand that there are certain things that are worth dying for. This is what it's coming down to, and we have to start drawing the line. That's quite literally what's coming down to.
Yeah, and it's not crazy. It's evil what we're facing.
It is evil. It is evil.
Yeah, I mean, it's to say crazy is to deprive it or not give its proper, not give these, you know. It's not acknowledging the evil behind it, not exactly the responsibility that people have who are promoting it.
Right.
And there's a certain method to insanity itself, because you're destroying standards, confusing everybody, and that's that breaking down.
Right.
Making, you know, a good example, I think New York City has a punitive law that says you have to address someone by the gender they identify as, not as who they are, or what they are.
Right, right.
And you can have a law, you can put someone in jail.
I mean,
in Germany, I think there are 62 genders. I was like, 62? Why are you such a stuffed shirt? Why not 80? Why not 100?
Yeah,
you know, it's insane. It's like,
it is insanity, and it's, you know, the noticeable thing is that they have to impose this by force.
Yes,
and that's the surest clue that the system that they're trying to impose is completely artificial and disconnected from reality.
Yeah, and this gets back to it's late in the interview, but this alchemical breakdown goes back to sort of the corruption of the Gnostic heresies about the whole nature of creation itself as being a mistake.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's exactly.
Male female was a mistake, so we have to break it down, because the original was androgynous, right? The whole idea of androgyny.
Well, the idea of androgyny you can find in some of the church fathers. It's not necessarily that they're subscribing to Gnosticism. Gnosticism itself does what you say it does. It views the material creation as a mistake, done by God, rather than as a consequence of the fall. That's quite a different thing, mm-hmm. which is what many of the church fathers thought. But, and for that matter, even some of the rabbinical commentators and scholars. But the problem, I think you put your head on it. You hit the nail on the head, and that is that in these systems, what you're essentially looking at. And I just did a webinar this past week for my members in the members area of my website. That what you're really looking at is dialectical Gnosticism dressed up in nice shiny new Marxist terms. But what we're looking at and confronting is something very, very, very old.
Mm-hmm. And just they just don't these the protesters, the SJWs, they just don't realize it, but they're just they're just useful idiots, or you know, they're like the crazy students in Mao's Cultural Revolution. They're sent out to harass and intimidate, and
that's exactly what you're seeing happen. Yeah. That is the parallel is, if you study the parallel between, you know, the revolution in 1967 and what's taking place in this country, the parallels are detailed and breathtaking.
Mm-hmm. And they put dunce caps on all the people who resist them.
Exactly.
In the stadium and all that. Well, Dr. Farrell, I want to thank you for coming back on the show.
Sure. Thanks for having me back on, Tim.
It's a great talk. I encourage everyone to buy the book, Rotten to the Common Core, Public Schooling, Standardized Test, and the Surveillance State. Of course, your other work is worth reading. The Giza Death Star, Reich of the Black Sun, the SS Brotherhood of the Bell, LBJ, and the Conspiracy to Kill Kennedy, the Nazi International, Hidden Finance, Rogue Networks, and the Secret Sorcery, the Fascist International, 9/11, and Penetrated Operations. All these books and the book we talked about tonight are all connected.
Yeah,
so,
they are.
I mean, so to get a full appreciation of this, read those books. They're extremely well read. They're entertaining and very provocative, and also also disturbing. But that's history. Wouldn't be interesting if it wasn't disturbing. Unfortunately. I mentioned your website, GizaDeathStar.com, right?
Yeah, it's
okay.
GizaDeathStar, all one word, .com.
Okay, anything else before we
No, that's all I can think of.
Okay, well, listen, I want to thank you for spending so much time with me. I know you had a rough night last night because of the storms. You're a little fatigued, so I'm going to let you go get some rest and catch up, and hopefully you won't get blown away tonight by Aaron.
I hope not. If the power stays on, I'll be happy.
So. Great.
All right, thanks,
excellent. Trey. Excellent. Great, I'll post this when I do. I'll send you the link.
All right, thank you.
Good night.
Yeah, good night.
Bye-bye.
Hold on my sanity. I'm a 20th century.